So good morning, everybody, and thank you to Define Health for inviting us to moderate and have four superb speakers here. And in keeping with the cancer meeting, we have a highly heterogeneous panel, hopefully not malignant, and we're going to cover a range of topics in terms of new MOAs and targets for cancer drug development. And you've got the background of each of the speakers in your book, so I won't go through their bios. Daryl, next slide, please. So what we're going to do is, picking up on this morning where Dr. Anderson set us off with the advances in hematology and myeloma, and then Dr. Chauver's excellent panel talked about ovarian cancer, we're going to lead off with Dr. Phil Kantoff of the Dana-Farber talking about some of the innovations in prostate cancer therapy. And Dr. Kantoff and I met 15 years ago when these were just good novel MOAs, and now they're actually drugs, and he can talk a little bit about the opportunities and challenges of actually turning some of these good ideas into new medicines. And what we'll do, because the next topics, Dr. Croce on microRNA and Dr. Schneider on mTOR inhibitors and protein synthesis, and then one of Paul Fisher, are very diverse, we'll stop after each talk and have some interactive dialogue before going to the next one. So let me start off with Phil Canto.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's really a pleasure to be invited back. I've spoken here before, and I haven't had much to talk about in the past, so I'm happy to come back and speak and be given 10 minutes to talk about the great advances that have taken place in the prostate cancer world over the past couple of years. So I'm going to start off by talking about drugs within the androgen signaling pathway. And as many of you know who follow the prostate cancer world, over the past decade, it's become clear that even after a patient becomes castration dependent, develops castration-independent prostate cancer, that is, progressive disease with low testosterone, they're still dependent on androgen signaling. And it's the basis of this that gave rise to two very important drugs in the prostate cancer space. One of them is abiraterone, which is an androgen synthesis inhibitor, much like an aromatase inhibitor in the context of breast cancer. It is a CYP17 lyase inhibitor, and it was first tested in this phase 3 study, the Cougar 301 study, in which patients had been who had metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer were randomized to receive either abiraterone or prednisone. And it turned out that even in this far advanced population, there was a 3.9-month median difference in overall survival, supporting the concept that continued suppression of androgens even after castration was important. In parallel, there was a drug that was developed that was an anti-androgen, and what I mean by that is it binds the androgen receptor, but beyond that, it has a couple other mechanisms of activity. It binds the androgen receptor as a competitive inhibitor, does not have agonistic activity. It prevents translocation of the androgen receptor into the nucleus and prevents binding of the androgen receptor to the nucleus. And in a very similar study in patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer who had previously received chemotherapy, patients were randomized to receive MDB-3100 or placebo, and the primary endpoint was overall survival. And very similarly, there was a difference in median survival in the range of 4.8 months, and the hazard ratio was 0.63. So both of these drugs supported the concept that there's continued importance of androgen signaling even after castration in men. And we know now that there is actually androgen still present in the prostatic tissue after castration. So what are the challenges in this space? One is a commercial one. Which drug will be used first? Abiraterone has a little bit of an albatross associated with it, which is it frequently needs to be used with prednisone because prednisone suppresses the increase in ACTH and the consequent increased mineralocorticoid activity. The dose of prednisone has not been worked out, but and there are some people who do not require prednisone. On the other hand, MDB-3100 has a very low seizure threshold. There are seizures that are seen in a subset of patients. So which one gets picked is up for debate. What will be the effect of the use of one of these drugs on the efficacy of the other. We're going to find out. What will be the utility of combining the drugs? I think it's going to be spectacular. I think there'll be synergy between the two. I think that you enhance the ability of MDV-3100 to bind to and have its effect on the androgen receptor by lowering the ambient amount of androgen around. That really has not been tested yet. How will other drugs in this pathway get approved? There are a number of other drugs, which are CYP17 lyase inhibitors, anti-androgens, that are have been developed and are being tested right now. How will they be approved in this crowded space of drug development? And most importantly to me is, what will be the effect of these drugs when used early in disease, when conceivably you can cure patients with disease rather than just extend lives by a few months? I think it's a very exciting area to go into, but a very daunting task for pharmaceutical companies to get into because the endpoints are so many years ahead. The second area I want to touch on is bone-targeted drugs. And it seems obvious in the case of prostate cancer, being a clinician, that you'd go after the bone. Because 90% of patients will develop bone metastases. They will die of bone metastases. So do something about the bone, and it should be advantageous. Now, zoledronic acid was tested about a decade ago. It's a bisphosphonate, and it was demonstrated to reduce skeletal-related events by 20%. I will say as a clinician that it has dramatically changed the natural history of this disease in the sense of diminishing the number of skeletal-related events and also the need for radiation, things like spinal cord compression. There was a study that was done a couple of years ago comparing the RANK ligand inhibitor denosumab to zoledronic acid. It was a huge study, 1,900 patients, and it demonstrated that denosumab was a slightly better drug in inhibiting skeletal-related events by about 18%, first skeletal-related event as well as second skeletal-related event. But neither of these two drugs in and of themselves or compared to each other alter overall survival or time to progression. The question of whether or not the RANK ligand inhibitor denosumab alters the natural history of disease was asked in this study, a study of over 1,400 patients, with the primary endpoint in these men with castration-resistant disease without metastases was time of first development of metastases. An important question. I thought it was biologically very, very interesting. And I hope you can see that, but the light line isn't coming out all that well from where I see it. Maybe you can see it better up there. I'm colorblind. But there was a small but statistically significant difference in the time to first and subsequent bone metastases associated with denosumab, which I found to be a rather fascinating phenomena. But it actually is quite a small difference. And, of course, the FDA found this to be a small difference, did not approve it, and keeping in line with the fact that time to progression is an insufficient endpoint in prostate cancer for approval of drugs, leaving overall survival as the main endpoint. So the conclusions with regard to prevention of skeletal-related events is patients do benefit from being put on a bone protective agent, zoledronic acid or denosumab. I think are reasonable alternatives. I think the marketplace is sort of favoring denosumab at this point. Optimal scheduling of these agents has not been determined, and there's considerations for individualizing, which I'm not going to go into detail right now, but there are times when one might want to use denosumab over a zoledronic acid and vice versa. What's interesting is that this drug radium-223, which sort of came out of nowhere, which is an alpha emitter. Now, we had had beta emitters in the field of prostate cancer for a number of years, strontium, samarium, and they have a long radius of activity. They cause single-strand DNA breaks. And for the most part, they were approved for prostate cancer for pain palliation. Along comes an alpha emitter, which is radium-223, which is a bone seeker. This drug has a short radius of activity and presumably causes double-strand DNA breaks. And after a very provocative randomized phase 2 study, which demonstrated a survival advantage associated with radium-223 over placebo, this larger phase 3 study was conducted in which patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer who were really quite advanced, had greater than 2 metastases, no visceral metastases, had received prior chemotherapy or not, were randomized to receive either radium-223 in 6 injections 4 weeks apart or placebo. And I found it quite remarkable, once again, that that light line isn't coming out all that well, but there was a difference of several months in favor of radium-223. So this is the first bone-active agent that alters really the natural history of disease with regard to overall survival. It's a very, very well-tolerated drug, at least in men with far advanced disease. The hemologic side effects are very minimal. Pain disappears. Interestingly, there are very, very few PSA responses in this disease. It may be because it takes a while for PSA to go down. I don't know the answer to that. The people who really benefit from this, it appears, are patients who have not yet received chemotherapy, which is an interesting observation that needs to be played out. The final thing I want to talk about is the emergence of immunotherapy in the field of prostate cancer. And as many of you know, the saga associated with Cipollucel-T or Provenge, there have been 2 early randomized phase 3 studies, which was small, positive with regard to overall survival, but negative with regard to the primary endpoint of time to progression, which did not meet FDA approval. So the IMPACT study was done. It did demonstrate an improvement of survival of about 4.1 months in men with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, a 38% improvement in survival at 3 years. But the interesting part of this story is how you take a positive phase 3 study and try to commercialize it. And I've witnessed this over the past 2 years. It's actually the 2-year anniversary in May. And it's been very, very difficult. First of all, the sticker shock associated with the $93,000 bill, which is given over a 4-week period of time, it actually is comparable to many of the other drugs that are given. But, paying for that amount of money in that short amount of time was overwhelming for many people. And there were initial reimbursement issues that surrounded it. There were some insurers that would not pay for it. The initial supply was not there. The demand was very high, which caused a lot of problems. There were a lot of coordination problems between Dendreon and the providers. And one of the important things was the lack of immediate response in patients. So PSAs would not go down. There wasn't a time to progression difference. But there was a consistent overall survival advantage. So preparing the patient appropriately for what they're going to get, I think, is very important. I think most importantly, Provenge is the opening door for immunotherapy in prostate cancer and in other areas of cancer, and I think it's an exciting advance in that light. Thank you very much. That's a snapshot.
Why don't we do the following? Let's have questions now for Dr. Kantoff before we switch to the next topic. So this paper is open.
Yes, sir.
The lack of PSA response, is that because there's no PSA-producing cells in the bone for which this alpha emitter is being targeted? Or what's your hypothesis why PSA doesn't appear to be a reasonable indicator?
Very low. So we're talking about radium-223.
Yeah.
Probably the kinetics of response to the drug is very slow. So you don't see a quick drop in PSA. I think if you look very carefully at PSA kinetics, the PSA tends to rise slower in people who have gotten radium-223 than in men who have not gotten it. But you don't see that plummet in PSA that you see with some of the other drugs like abiraterone or MBV-3100.
Okay. And none of these patients had visceral metastases?
They were excluded from the study.
Excluded.
Yeah, it's bone-only disease. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Phil, how do you see the abiraterone and MD-3100 in the setting where
if you move earlier, you've got androgen ablation, and how those trials are going to get designed, and what is your thought on that?
Well, I think it's a very, just taking all the commercialization issues aside, I think it's very exciting to me to think about using much, much better hormonal drugs earlier in disease, which have never been done before, either in the context of with radiation or in the rising PSA population as initial hormonal therapy. I think the optimal use of these drugs is going to be together, in fact, because it a drug like abiraterone is going to enhance the ability of MDP-3100 to work, presumably, at least in vitro, that's the case. Whether, you know, if you're talking about sequence of these two drugs, I think what's going to happen is really a toxicity issue. At the moment, it appears that MDP-3100 wins that. But there's theoretical reasons to want to start with abiraterone first. I don't know how it's going to be played out. What I would like to see is these drugs used very early in disease, very used together, but those studies have not been done yet. I think we'll actually be able to cure people with high-risk disease that need to be cured if used used together.
Well, one last question, Dr. Cohen. There's one more after that. Okay, go ahead.
I'm curious about the comment that you made about continued androgen dependence of these tumors. And my question is specific. When I was a fellow almost 30 years ago, we learned that they progressed to a state of androgen independence. Mm-hmm. How did we go so fundamentally wrong to have only recognized this in the last couple of years when you have a cognate disease, breast cancer, which demonstrates exactly the same dependence?
Well, actually, let it be known that Jack Geller, in the 1980s...
Somebody got it right. I know.
Somebody did get it right. Jack Geller did get it right. He actually did biochemical assays in tumors 30 years ago. Everybody ignored him. They said, you know, that the assays weren't good. The drugs that we had were not good enough. They were not good. They suppressed the testicular supply of androgen. You were able to lower serum testosterone levels to below 50. We were all happy with that. In all honesty, the real receptive biologists were saying there's still more stuff going on there, and we just didn't have the tools to explore the possibility of doing better than we had done. But we did get it wrong for 30 years, and now it's time to get it right.
Last question for this section.
I'm curious about the setting where you try to prevent the emergence of bone metastases, where DMAP did its 147 trial. What do you think is the path forward? I mean, if the FDA has said no to the PFS endpoint and sponsors are unwilling to go down the OS route because of the size of trials, is there a middle ground anywhere?
Yeah. So the question is, DMAB, the study demonstrating a delay in the development of bone metastases, the problem with that study is twofold. One is it's precedent setting to approve a drug that is not associated with an overall survival advantage, yet delays bone metastases. So in order to do that, and I think it is doable, you need a drug that's so robust that you need to do better than a few month difference in delaying bone metastases. You need to delay metastases by a much longer period of time than what was seen. So it was a combination of magnitude of effect and a new paradigm. And when you see that sort of stuff, people grapple with it. I think if we had a drug that delayed metastases, I'm going to just say 8 months, 12 months, that might impress some people that you're actually changing the natural history of the disease. And in this particular study, there was no difference in overall survival. You know, so there was very little in my mind to support it. But I do think there is a path forward. I think with a better drug that alters the natural history of the disease in a more profound way, I think we can get over this awful hurdle of needing overall survival in prostate cancer to approve every drug. Thank you.
Okay, we're now going to switch from prostate cancer to some of the more novel MOAs, and we're fortunate to have Dr. Cola Croce, to talk about microRNAs and some of the implications in both prognostics, diagnostics, and therapeutic applications for cancer.
Dr. Kirsch.
By now, you all know what the microRNA are. They are a small RNA molecule, about 21-22 nucleotides in length, that are regulators of gene expression. And they regulate gene expression predominantly by binding to site at the 3' and translated region of messenger RNA. And when that occurs, you have degradation of the target messenger RNA and a block of translation of that RNA. So essentially, they are regulator of gene expression. There is quite a complicated processing involving microRNA. They are transcribed for the most part by RNA polymerase II, and then the large transcripts are cleaved by DROJA and a smaller precursor, about 7,500 nucleotide in length, go to the cytoplasm where it is further cleaved by another endonuclease complex containing DROJA. And then the double-stranded microRNA unwind, and the mature strand is incorporated in a complex that essentially regulate the expression of the messenger RNA. Now, many years ago, we found that alteration in microRNA gene, and we demonstrated that in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, lead to malignancy. And in fact, we could reproduce the disease, that CLL, that was caused by deletion of this microRNA by making knockout mice. So it looks pretty clear that with genetic alteration in microRNA, you can develop a cancer. And you can have deletion in certain microRNA leading to cancer. You can have gene amplification of certain microRNA, like miR-155 in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and that also inducing cancer. And you can reproduce the disease in the mouse by overexpressing that oncogenic microRNA, and the mice will develop an aggressive B-cell lymphoma, an aggressive leukemia. Now, what it comes out from many studies is that the expression of microRNA is absolutely tissue-specific and cell-type specific, and the pattern of expression of microRNA can allow you to distinguish between different cell types, between different stages of differentiation, and so on. But probably the most important finding, which has a great implication, is that every pathway which is involved in cancer pathogenesis regulates directly specific set of microRNA. Okay? So the major reason why in cancer, in every human cancer, in every mouse cancer, we observe dysregulation of microRNA, with some microRNA are up and some microRNA are down, is due to the fact that the pathway which are involved in the pathogenesis of that cancer regulate directly and dysregulate directly a number of microRNA. And therefore, we can take advantage of microRNA dysregulation for a better diagnosis, for prognosis, and monitoring of therapy. But since every respectable transcription factor regulates a number of microRNA, shutting down the expression of some and enhancing the expression of other, essentially, we can target the pathway which is responsible for cancer pathogenesis just by targeting the downstream microRNA. I give you an example. MYC regulates a number of microRNA, and the transcription factor MYC, which is today an untargetable oncogene and probably is what we call the emperor of the oncogene because it is regulated in a number of malignancy, MYC takes down a number of microRNA like miR-23 and miR-26 and enhances the expression of some microRNA. Now, it is pretty clear that we can target MYC induced dysregulation using microRNA and anti-microRNA. For example, you can induce a cancer by MYC, and you can just target miR-26, replacing miR-26 in the cancer cell, and the cancer cell will die. Why? Because they are dependent on that pathway for survival. And if you can alter the expression of the microRNA, which are directly regulated by the specific oncogene, you just kill the cell. Okay? And therefore, I think that microRNA and microRNA dysregulation will be exploited extensively, not only for better diagnostic and prognostic and monitoring of cancer, but will be used in therapy, because microRNA can always be targeted. Now, the question is how to target the specific cancer tissue. For some tissue, it's not a big deal, because, for example, for liver and kidney and bone marrow, this tissue pick up microRNA spontaneously at a pretty good rate, okay? For other tissue, the treatment is more complicated. We will have to devise targeting way where we can send specifically microRNA or anti-microRNA to specific tissue. But, for example, we have shown the most dysregulated microRNA in hepatocellular carcinoma are miR-221 and 222, which are about 10 to 30-fold higher in hepatocellular carcinoma than in normal liver. We recently, at the working press, we could induce an hepatocellular carcinoma in the mouse just by dysregulating one microRNA, miR-221, in liver using the albumin promoter enhancer element. And this mice developed hepatocellular carcinoma. When the tumor is developed in the transgenic mice, we can shoot intravenously an anti-miR-221, and the tumors regress. Okay? So if you can identify the pathway or the microRNA that are dysregulated in specific human cancer, you can start thinking about taking advantage of that dysregulation to develop a specific anti-cancer therapy. With that, I close, and you can ask me all the questions you want.
Okay, this paper is open for questions. We got a mic down here, please.
Hi. There's been a great deal of interest on circulating tumor cells and isolating microRNA, and then, of course, that's been challenged, or no, I wouldn't say challenged, but certainly becoming of great interest is exosomes and isolating different actors from the exosomes, all of which are supposedly leading to early picking up of potential cancers. There's a lot of work done now also coming from urine and so forth. Could you comment on that? Because
yeah,
the real question is there's been no concordance so far. There's just been a lot of data generated.
Yeah. There is a question of that we have distinguished between cancer cells which are in circulation, circulating cancer cells, and microRNA in blood. Okay, there are two different issues. MicroRNA in blood are present. They are present in normal individuals, and they are present also in cancer patients. And it's pretty clear from many recent studies that we can detect dysregulation of microRNA specifically associated with given malignancy. In a study that we have published last year, we have examined 1,064 plasma of individuals who smoked a pack of cigarettes a day for over 10 years. And these people were studied by spiral CT. So at the moment they got to the hospital and gave their blood, they were studied for the presence of masses in their lung. Okay? And these 1,064 people were negative when they started the study. And then these people every year went to the cancer center of National Cancer Center in Milan, Italy, and again gave blood, and they were exposed. They were studied by spiral CT. We could detect a signature in the blood, in the plasma of this patient, specific for lung cancer 2 years before spiral CT. Okay? So by looking at blood, at either serum or plasma, we can even detect the presence of a malignancy before a very sensitive approach. This for as far as diagnostic. Now, in the blood, microRNA can be bound to proteins or can be in exosome or microvesicle. The difference between microvesicle and exosome is just size. The exosomes are about 100 nanometers. The microvesicles are larger, okay? And it is clear that a number of cancer cells are sending into the blood large quantity of microvesicles and exosomes. And I think, or I start to think, that this microvesicle and exosome containing microRNA might be playing a major role in the interaction that occurs between cancer cell and cell of the microenvironment. But it's a little bit too early to say. But it's clear that we can take advantage of microRNA in blood for diagnosis and prognostic purposes.
What do you think the function of the circulating microRNAs are?
I would like to address it a little bit more extensively, but the work is in press, so I prefer to not to talk about it. But it is clear that this microRNA, that physiologically there is a role for microvesicle and exosome. In other words, it's a physiologic process. Okay? In the case of cancer, larger quantities of microRNA are sent into the blood, and in addition, some of those microRNA that are most dysregulated in the cancer cell happen to be most dysregulated in the exosome and the microvesicle, okay? And then this payload can be unloaded on cell of the microenvironment and could be unloaded also.
So there's at least shedding.
Yeah.
But there's some, what you're alluding to is there's some physiological function that...
Oh, for must be, because otherwise why normal cell will shed, okay? But for example, you take, you know, the old story of 3T3 that can differentiate in adipocytes, okay? And you can allow this differentiation in vitro, and you will see that these adipocytes are shedding microvesicle and exosome that are shed by normally by adipose cell, okay? And this microvesicle and exosome might have some very important role, okay? Depending on the quantity.
Wait for that publication.
Just to keep, thank you very much, Dr. Croce. Just to keep the time going, we're now going to ask Dr. Bob Schneider from NYU to do a presentation.
Thank you and good morning. So I'd like to talk about the end game for the typical tumor, and that's protein synthesis. And this is not an area which has received a lot of attention, but it's eminently quite druggable. And so I'd like to tell you a little bit about our efforts and efforts of some of my colleagues to actually use the differences in protein synthesis of tumor cells for drug development. And we have some partial successes. We do have one drug in phase 2 clinical trials in metastatic breast and other cancers that's showing some real efficacy. So why protein synthesis? And the topic for this morning's session, of course, is new emerging areas. And this is an area which, until the development of rapalogs and mTOR, received very little attention. So we're involved in three aspects, and I'll tell you a bit about all three of those. One of those is to utilize catalytic inhibitors of mTOR. So we all know that the rapalogs, rapamycins, have shown some marginal efficacy in some cases. But there's some real issues with their use, and so we and others are developing catalytic inhibitors of mTOR. We're doing first-in-human trials right now. And the whole field of mTOR and protein synthesis presents us with some real issues, which have really come up in the course of these last 2 days. And one of those has to do with converting the way we look at response to biological responses, the other, which we've already addressed, but is a major issue in this area, is the lack of efficacy as single agents. And in fact, I'll take you through this, but the entire protein synthetic pathway has been designed precisely for that reason. So there are selective changes within tumor cells that, unless we stress those tumor cells, for example, with DNA damage chemotherapeutics, we won't see a response. So we're pushing some of these drugs towards an MTD, and that's the wrong approach, and I'll take you through some of that. And then finally, RNA itself, the messenger RNA itself, is highly druggable. We don't often think about that, but certain selective features of messenger RNAs, for example, VEGF-A, which we have drugged, has unique structures which permit it to be translated within the tumor cell under cell stress. And we can develop pharmacologic chemical inhibitors to those unique structures. They have as much structure, and they are as druggable as our proteins. We haven't really captured very much of that as well. So by way of full disclosure, yes, I'm at NYU, and yes, I'm a poorly paid professor there. But that's also why I've helped start several biotech companies. And I am a founding scientist of PTC Therapeutics, and I will talk a bit about PTC-299 this morning, which I've co-developed. First, let's talk a bit about mTOR. So what we've come to understand through our work and that of colleagues of mine as well is that mTOR is a central gatekeeper of protein synthesis in the cell. And so the first question is, why protein synthesis? And the answer is that 80% of all of the energy of the tumor cell goes into protein synthesis. It's the end game. And so by shutting down mTOR, we can really shut down proliferation and survival. But what we've come to understand is that so-called oncogenic messenger RNAs are actually preferentially translated in tumor cells with hyperactivation of these protein synthetic pathways. So protein synthesis is not equal, and certain mRNAs, such as survivin and VEGF and c-MYC and a number of others, a number of the DNA repair factor messenger RNAs, they have selective requirements that are utilized within cancer cells. And we've shown that if we just downregulate mTOR activity by 20 to 30%, it has no impact on most cells, but it selectively inhibits the ability to translate this whole class of oncogenic mRNAs. So here's the problem, and that is that we're doing first-in-human trials looking for MTDs and going for dose-limiting toxicities, when in fact all we really need to do is inhibit TOR activity by about 30%. And that's a real challenge because we need biological endpoints, as we've been talking about. It's a real challenge because as single agents, most of these drugs have very little activity. But with judicious use in combinatorial treatment, for example, with DNA damage agents, we see really excellent activity. And I'll give you an example of that. Second, as I said, RNA structures. One of the things we did at PTC Therapeutics, after we had discovered that there are selective mechanisms for translation of angiogenesis mRNAs, such as VEGF, was to utilize the RNA itself in a high-throughput screen in a cell-based assay. And we were able to show that it was easy to make drugs against RNA because many of them are based on intercalating agents that then we have to fiddle with in order to make them quite specific. So we turned one of those into a drug. It's called PTC-299. We brought it through trial. We had some issues with FDA because they're so well tolerated, we didn't hit a maximum tolerated dose. But in the end, we've moved into phase two trials in metastatic breast in a number of centers at NYU, Memorial Sloan Kettering, Mass General, and elsewhere. And what we have found is that it's working quite well in shutting down the translation by hitting the target being the RNA of VEGF-A, c-MYC, IL-6, and PDGF. They share the same translation mechanism. So we're seeing excellent efficacy right now in a small phase 2 trial of 24 women with metastatic breast cancer, ER positive, being treated only with an aromatase inhibitor and PTC-299 twice daily. It's orally available. So this is a whole area we need to think about in the development of better drugs. We can get the most selective targeting by targeting the messenger RNA. And then finally, certain translation factors are overexpressed. So the factors that actually conduct protein synthesis are overexpressed in different types of human cancers. So we've shown that metastasis in breast and several other cancers is conducted by overexpression or overactivation of several translation factors, EIF4E, for which there's quite a bit of attention, EIF4G. And we now have small molecule inhibitors of EIF4E and EIF4A, two factors. Preclinically, they look pretty good. It faces the same challenge. We see absolutely no effect in preclinical models on tumor regression or even tumor response until we hit them with combinatorial treatments such as DNA damage, because the reason that they are so highly activated in tumor cells is precisely so that they can cause the selective translation under stress, such as hypoxia, DNA damage as well. So this is a challenge for clinical introduction. We're hoping to have these in the clinic in about 3 years from now, and in discussions with the FDA as well, but requires, as we've been talking about for the last 2 days, that we move to biological responses for the determination of activity, and presents another problem in the phase one, and that is that unless we're really smart about this, although we do always design phase one trials, of course, for toxicity-limiting analysis, if we're smart, we can also glean a bit of an understanding about biological activity. How do we get these agents into a phase one trial where we might see some biological activity? And the way we've gone about that is to be very careful, such as, for example, introduction in the treatment of GBM with dose escalation of our drug plus conventional radiotherapy typically radiotherapy and temozolomide, for example. And so we're allowed to actually dose escalate under those conditions as well. You can do the same in rectal cancers as well. So it requires a very different way to think about the introduction and development of a clinical trial for these kinds of agents. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Dr. Schneider. We have time for one or two questions. An excellent presentation, and hope you'll be around after. But take one or two burning questions for the speaker.
All right, no burning questions. Thank you.
Okay. Last speaker is Dr. Paul Fisher at VCU. He's going to talk about gene therapy and viral, but I'm just going to add a little tidbit. We had dinner last night, and among Dr. Fisher's many talents, he played basketball, and in the 1960s played against a guy named Lou Alcindor, who is better known as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. So after the talk, ask him how he blocked the best hook shot in the history of the NBA. Dr. Fisher?
Well, with that introduction, I should just end it. But, I guess it wouldn't be appropriate unless we had something about viruses discussed. I want to also make a disclaimer. I put the slides together in a cab coming up here. I was just told that they might be helpful in walking people through this. So just in case, I mean, how do we use this? Is this going to actually work with the slides or... It's pressing. Okay. Let's try it this way. Okay. So what I'd like to do is discuss a little bit about viruses and really why viruses have failed, and is there a better way of using these, and is it really a fixable problem in such that we can now develop a therapy that really may work? Obviously, I wouldn't be talking about this if we didn't believe strongly that there is an avenue for doing these approaches, and why has this not worked in the past? One is inefficient transduction and lack of true cancer specificity. So even viruses we thought would have profound activity in a cancer versus a normal cell have shown some surprises when one has gone into the clinics. Also, it's never been possible really to get enough of the genetic material into the tumors to really have a profound biological effect. So it's been, in quotes, very disappointing. Viral replication alone does not work, and we've learned these lessons in a number of clinical trials. Some companies have started, some companies have failed. Basic bottom line is a virus by itself that just replicates does not work clinically. We've gone back and now looked at the possibility of combining viruses and making what are called bipartites, in which they not only replicate, but when they replicate, they produce an active cytokine that can be released and actually find distant tumors. For those of you who are not familiar with IL-24, it's an IL-10 family member that has profound clinical activities. It's gone into a phase one clinical trial in intratumoral administration with a 44% objective response, which is really not heard of in a viral gene therapy trial. It's secreted. It has a profound bystander effect. It will find receptors on cancer cells, induce ER stress, and kill the cancer. It works really well when you add it with other therapeutic agents. So you don't have to abandon therapy X. You can combine this, and the effect is usually synergistic. Okay. Trapping of the virus. So I'm going to come to two other aspects, and then I'm going to show a couple more slides, and then I'd be happy to answer questions. The other problem has been, how do you deliver viruses systemically? You put them in the bloodstream, and your liver becomes your worst enemy in that it traps most of the virus, and it never gets to the cancer. Additionally, the immune system, which helps us, hinders the ability of the virus to work because it clears it. So the questions are, can you get over these hurdles? And I'd like to propose to you that, yes, we can. That shows you that was part of the cab ride. Viruses called cancer terminator viruses, and I'm going to walk you through really quickly. I could take you about 10 hours to do this, but I won't. We use subtraction hybridization. We actually pioneered the approach back in the 90s, which give away age, when I was much better than Kareem, but that was earlier. I think he surpassed me in basketball prowess. But basic bottom line is, if you look at this panel, this PEG promoter, which was one of the genes we classified, is essentially dead in normal cells and active in all cancers we've looked at. These are cell lines. It works in primary tumor tissue as well. And the basic bottom line, it's operated by two transcription factors that are upregulated in essentially 99% of cancers. So it's being driven by transcription factors that fuel the cancer. So we've gone back and we've made very interesting viruses. And these viruses, replication is controlled by this promoter. And when it replicates, it produces its second gene product. And the hypothesis was, in normal cells, you'd have no effect, and in cancer, you would kill it. Yes, it does work in nude mice, but as many colleagues have told me, you can cure any nude mouse out there. But that's a lot different when you come to people. And the basic bottom line, this is a peritoneal metastasizing prostate cancer in a nude mouse. And the bottom line is, the terminator virus shown on the far panel can actually cure these mice of the disease. However, you know, this is not the end all. The real problem is, how do you get the virus to the target and not have, again, it cleared or the liver trapping it? We've pioneered an approach called microbubble technology, in which we can take viruses and put them in polyfluorocarbonate bubbles. You can decorate the bubble to target it to specific tissue. And when you use ultrasound, you can now release the virus uniquely in that target. We had a recent PNAS paper where we actually showed we could do this in an immune-competent animal. So we can bypass the immune system and actually deliver this directly to the prostate or other organs. And the advantage is, when it's there, it releases its cytokine and affects other tumor cells. I'm going to show you where we are now, and it's coming into proposed clinical trials. We've had pre-IND discussions, and we're really very close. The final toxicology is being done, and we hope within 8 months to a year to actually start a trial in malignant glioma. And we've used a modified virus, which is tropism modified. One other aspect for those who work in the virus field is, adeno gets into cells by CAR receptors. These are Coxsackie adenovirus receptors. Cancers are insidious. They tend to down-regulate CAR receptors, so the virus that would work really well just can't get in. So we've worked on making serotype conversion antibodies that actually use alternate receptors so that they can get into their target. So this was another issue. How do you transduce? Well, you don't use CAR. You use CAR and you use something else. And desmoglein 2 becomes another target to actually get the virus into cells. So we've done this in malignant glioma. I'm going to show you just one example in brain tumor studies, which have been very exciting. This is a human GBM that's primary, that's maintained in animals. And when you inject it in the brains of animals, these animals die by 40 days. It's an invasive tumor. It forms a butterfly in the brain, just like a malignant glioma does in a patient. If you use a virus that only expresses MDA7, which is the second panel, you have survival, but there's clearly signs that the tumor is there. If you use a replication-only virus, there's less of an effect. And if you use the one that has the terminator in it, where you have IL-24 being expressed as well as replication, you get a profound effect. This is an example of survival curves, which were actually carried out to 400 days, where a single injection in the brain of an animal cured 50% of the animals with a dose that was not would be probably an order of magnitude lower than in humans. So this data has been provided to the FDA. Preclinical trials have been done in Syrian hamster. Again, I'm giving you a complete primer in adenovirology at this point. They're semi-permissive for adeno. If it replicates, it will kill the hamster. This virus was completely dead when injected either systemically or directly into the brains of animals. So this is really ready to go, and we're doing the study at VCU as well as the University of Chicago with Matt Lesniak. There'll be a dual program to look at this at two institutions. So what we hope is happening, and what we hope will be in a while, is if you take and you have metastatic disease, the issue is, you know, if you can get the virus to the target, the virus will enter both normal and cancer cells, but only the cancer cells will allow this virus to replicate and produce the second cytokine. I also didn't mention that MDA7 has this, you know, other attribute in that it's potent, a modulator of the immune system. We've been using this now with chaperone proteins to develop a vaccine effect. So you're getting really multiple benefits here. You're killing the cancer. You're affecting the vasculature. You're sensitizing it to killer T cells and other immune modulatory cells. And you're also setting up a system for future prevention of the disease. So we believe that when these viruses replicate, they will be released. It's really the cytokine that's the key that will affect the metastasis at different sites. And then we predict and we hope that you will have a situation where the tumor is destroyed. This is what it simply looks like. A shows you the bubble, which is now put into the circulation. We can then use ultrasound to release this. And we've actually shown that this process does work. We're applying it to prostate cancer now, but literally it can be used in any cancer. And the PEG promoter has also been used for imaging. We had a recent Nature Medicine paper where we can visualize METs. So you can use this now to target and deliver a therapeutic, which is called theranostics, which is the approach we are now. And now, of course, the dismal part is the fact it's now becoming, we heard this even last night during the dinner, that getting something peer-reviewed becomes extremely difficult. And the way science really works now is if it's a good idea, but it's in front of its time, it'll never get funded. If you talk about a virus, you got real troubles. But the bottom line is, you know, we've done okay. And all for disclosure also, I was also a poor academician that started a company that was called GenQuest. GenQuest merged with Corixa. We went public and then finally traded to GSK. So it was an interesting experience and a road. We're also, since I have 1 minute left here, I see, have used this for small molecule screening. So, which is with the Stanford Burnham Medical Research Institute. And this molecule and the promoter is a readout. So you can now look at small molecules that will inhibit cancer and just simply use that readout to now determine if they have anti-cancer activity. And we now have compounds that have come out of high throughput out of Orlando, and we're starting to modify them, and some are even in second chemistry stages. So I do not believe that a single gene alone or a single virus is going to be a cure. and I'm not trying to propose that, but I think as part of an armamentarium with other small molecule inhibitors, perhaps microRNAs that are going to be really quite interesting, protein modulation is another way, but combining these together could give us a powerful tool for combating cancer. And I have 7 seconds left, so thank you. We'll take one or two questions for Dr. Fisher on the cancer terminator virus. You do get coffee after this. You're allowed to ask a question. Question over here, please.
So you've invested quite a bit of time into getting the virus to other locations other than the liver. What did you find or colleagues of yours find for cancers of the liver? Because one of the big problems with liver cancer is metastases from other tissues to the liver and getting treatments there that could be effective.
That's a perfect question. And what we do is we don't use the targeting on-off with this. We actually will utilize it and actually focus it right in the liver. And it works really well in the liver with hepatocarcinomas. I should indicate also that MDA7 has had these remarkable, when we first discovered this, we got hit on one grant because they said, why isn't anyone else working on it? That's when P53 was popular. There are now maybe 400 publications in the area, and it's worked on almost every cancer that people have looked at. Only exception has been pancreatic, and there's a translational issue, which Bob alluded to, which if we modify translational ability, it will kill pancreatic as well.
Another question?
Yeah, so having trained originally in virology, I empathize with the challenge is that when you say the word, you're using a virus or oncolytic virus. So I'm curious, has there been any sea change amongst prospective partners, investors, et cetera, that you've been talking with, or even potential collaborators at centers post the Amgen BioVex deal? Has that kind of helped raise the...
I think it's now there's been greater interest. I think what will really change this is when you do a clinical trial, you show it's safe, and you show some objective response. That's always going to be the key. The brain tumor one was chosen for a number of reasons. I mean, you'll debulk the tumor. There's direct access to the tumor environment. And we estimate we only infect maybe 15% of the tumor, yet 100% die. So this is because it also has a circulatory bystander effect. So as it's secreted, it turns on an engine, and it will turn on MDA7 IL-24 production in normal cells and cancer cells. The cancer cell undergoes ER stress and dies. The normal cell lives but secretes it. So you get this radiant effect, which was also seen in the phase 1 study where this was a non-replicating virus. You got it into 30% of the cancer, but 80% died. So,
okay. Thank you very much for our speakers.
Great job. I think there's a short coffee break before the next meeting.